JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast.
Welcome to the JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast. I'm your host, Toshihisa Mikaido. Today we will be talking with Stefan Bonardi, who recently finished a five-year contract working with space robotics at JAXA. We will discuss the objectives of robotics and space robotics, go over missions including sending robots into lunar lava tubes and creating solar sails for space travel. We'll discuss collaborations and working with external fields such as medical professionals for robotic needs on Earth. We go over Stefan's history studying at EPFL and MIT, where he worked on multiple modular robots, and discuss the way he separates his work and technology from personal time and nature. Please enjoy. So today's guest is former JAXA International Top Young Fellow, robotics researcher from the JAXA Institute of Space and Astronautical Science, Stefan Bonardi. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be there.
So I understand until recently you were researching robotics and space robotics in particular at JAXA, and you were doing this for, I think, about 5 years or so. Can you tell us what this entails? What exactly were you doing at JAXA, and what is space robotics in particular?
Those are very vast questions. So I will start with the first one. So I joined JAXA in 2017 with a goal of creating the future space robot that would help accomplish the ambitious space mission that most of the space agency and JAXA in particular have in mind. And this entails creating both new type of hardware for those robots, which makes them more robust and more efficient in their mission, but also new type of control system so that they can work together instead of being single units. And also they can work with future human settlers when we will send them on the moon or in the further future on Mars. So the goal was really to start from scratch and try to reinvent a bit what a space robots could be. And space robotics in general is a study of trying to apply the concept of robotics for the challenging mission in space. It's basically trying to replicate what we can do on Earth, but in very difficult environment where we don't have access to the machine, where we need to make them autonomous, where we need to teleoperate them. It shares some characteristics with some problems that we have on Earth, like, for example, the decommissioning of nuclear power plants is one of them, or everything related to search and rescue mission where people cannot access difficult spaces. And here, those type of robots and the space robots share a lot of similarities.
You're saying that one of the main features of space robotics itself is having robots that can function and do jobs in areas where humans cannot easily access for one reason or another.
Yes, this is one key characteristic. I must add that maybe another one is very important, that the space environment is very tough for everything based on electronics. And then, of course, as you must know, the space environment has a very high dose of radiation. Mm-hmm. And those radiation, so space radiation, they will damage very easily all the electronics of machines and also biosystems. But for machine, it means that we need special electronics, special hardware so that we can withstand those radiation. And this is something that we don't have on Earth, of course, because we have a protective layer around the Earth. But this is something we need to take into account for those space robots. So it drastically limits what we can do, and it makes it way more challenging.
So when you say that you need special hardware, is this just the material that's used when you develop these robots, or is there really something specific about how you put the robots together that would shield them from things like radiation and other problems that you would encounter in space?
So I would say it's both. In terms of electronics, there is a special line of electronics devices that are developed specifically for space applications, both in terms of CPU and just electronics in general. Most of them are shielded in order to be able to resist to this type of radiation, and they have also special architecture. But also, as you mentioned, the way you assemble the robot and the way you protect those different elements is also something that is specific to the space domain. So it's not only in terms of radiation, but also in terms of temperature variation or in terms of environment in general, I would say.
Sounds like there's definitely a lot of things that you need to consider in this sort of situation that you wouldn't need to consider on Earth. And I suppose gravity is another one of those things, not just the radiation and temperature, but whether you're working in space or on another celestial body such as Mars or the Moon. You mentioned Mars earlier. Having robots potentially assist future human settlers with the development of habitats. The thing that's interesting here, or the thing that I want to ask you about, is this sounds like something that's extraordinarily long term. You know, I don't know what the field of everybody listening to the podcast in particular would be, but I think most people's jobs, they would see to some degree the fruits of their labor within, you know, 5 years, 3 years, some people that very day. When you're thinking about robots that could assist with habitats on Mars, how far into the future do you think this is? Is this something, you know, 30 years from now? Is this 100 years from now? Is this something that you will even be able to see yourself, do you think?
Yeah, I want to be optimistic and say that I would be able to see it myself. But I think you're completely right. This might be one of the specificity also of the of space robotics, is that most of the time the mission we're working on or the topic we're working on will find some application in decades. So usually I would say the time frame for one mission is around a decade at least from the start to the first launch or the deployment of your solution on the Moon, for example, or in the ISS and so on. So of course, this is a long time, but you have to take into account that this is kind of a mix between fundamental research, where the goal is really further into the future, but this has also application along the way. I mean, it's not the end, the end product is not the only thing that is interesting there or beneficial. In a project, for example, like automated construction, on the Moon or on Mars using robots, I mean, you can already find sub-application along the way, like applying the same algorithm or the same techniques on Earth to do building and to do testing. And by doing so, in fact, you can already test your approach in a different environment, but you can already kind of prune the bad solution way more easily. So I would say, in a sense, this helps having achievements not only at the end, but also while you're developing your solution. So I think that's what makes it also quite interesting.
That's definitely good to hear, because I was going to ask you, you know, how, if you have to wait, you know, a decade or longer to see the results of your work, how would you make changes along the way? And I think this is something that comes up with, you know, pretty much any industry or even, you know, personal goals at that level. You know, you have to start moving, and then, you know, make course corrections along the way. And I guess it's similar to a GPS, right? A lot often you don't even know what way you're facing with some of those GPS systems. And until you actually start to walk in one direction, you won't even know if you're headed in the right direction or not. If you don't have some sort of achievements or milestones along the way, then I think there'd be a lot of anxiety with setting on a 10-year goal and you don't even know if you're in the right direction or not. So that's definitely good to know that there's, you know, applications along the way that go along with the fundamental research. Could you give us any specific examples? If you were building a robot to function in space, what kind of situation or what kind of application could they be used in on Earth prior to the actual space activities?
So I think it's also a very good point, and maybe I can use the same example as you were mentioning before about construction. So as you know, construction on Earth is mainly done manually. I mean, you have a manual operator moving big piece of machinery to build, let's say, building or big structures. But as you also know, probably in Japan, there is a shortage of manpower, and it's increasingly difficult to sustain the development of societies like that. And one solution could be to automatize part of the process of building infrastructures using robots. And to do so, we need solutions that are quite efficient, but also safe for human operators. So in this particular case, there have been, in fact, quite a lot of push to develop automated solution for buildings by keeping human in the loop, but by also providing assistance in order to make the process easier and faster and more reliable. And those same technology that are used there, for example, in terms of control of the different robots, in terms of interaction with the operators, in terms of interaction between the robots themselves, I mean, all of that can be ported, in fact, to the space domain. So starting by developing a solution for Earth and afterwards adapting it to the space domain is something that is usually a good way to proceed. It's pretty rare that you have the opposite, that you develop a solution, a robot for space, and then that you will use the same robot for Earth application. It's usually more, let's say, the other way around, mainly because for the simple reason that you need to test your hardware on Earth, because this is the only thing that you have access to, either Earth or the International Space Station. So developing solution for Earth first makes more sense and would give you more data than you would do the other way around. So that's usually what we would do in this case.
That definitely makes sense. Most people anyway, most institutions, even those such as JAXA or NASA or others that do have some direct line to the International Space Station, probably would prefer to be able to do research on Earth just due to the ease and lower cost of such things. When it comes to your research in particular, do you also start with an Earth-based problem in mind before branching that out into what could be done with it in space? Or do you start by thinking about the other way around, what could be done in space, and then how could that also be applicable to Earth? Or maybe you do both.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say that it's most of the time both, because there are, of course, things that if you were to only take into account what you would do on Earth, it would be very difficult to adapt afterwards your system for some space-specific problems. And the other way around is true. So we need to find basically what is common between both environment and what is different. And when you have those two aspects in mind, then it will allow you to better define what you should start with and what you should develop first, what you can test first, and what you need to be careful with afterwards if you want to port the system to the space domain. What good way, usually the way of proceeding when you develop the space system is really that you will start by developing a system that is not what we call space ready. It's a mock-up system that will basically have almost the same functionality as the things you are trying to develop for space, but without having the extra complexity related to the space environment, as we mentioned before, the radiation, the thermal control, and so on. So this is a simplified system, but that already exhibits most of the capabilities of the system you would like to use in your space domain. So, and it will allow for nice testing in this case for you. And also it will allow you to see if the system is basically working for what you have in mind. But this is usually the balance that you are trying to achieve.
You mentioned a lot about space robotics up to this point and that there's a lot of research going into it. But what are the current objectives of space robotics? And I guess more importantly or concurrently, what are the current weaknesses of space robotics? What do you think needs to be developed more or is currently lacking to some degree?
So I think this is again a very big question. And that's I don't want to make enemies by replying. But so I would say if you look at space robotics, space robots, in fact, have been instrumental in many of the great scientific discoveries of the past 50 years. One of the most famous robots would be, for example, the Curiosity rovers on Mars. I mean, I think everybody almost knows it. And it has led to tremendous breakthrough in terms of science. But right now, let's say the main issue we are facing in this domain is that we have been shifting from purely scientific research to something more akin to colonization, or let's say building bases on other planets, on the moon or on Mars in the future. And of course, those objectives are not equivalent. Building robots for scientific discoveries or building robots that would help to create space colonies are two different things. And all the hardware that we have been developing for one particular case cannot really be directly used in the second case. Because of course, those type of system like the Curiosity rovers is not is a system that is restricted to a given set of tasks for given set of scientific objectives. But this is a system that is not sustainable in the long run. So you could not use this robot, for example, for construction. You would need another specialized robot. You could not use this robot to extract resources on site. You would need another specialized robot. And as you probably know, those robots like Curiosity are extremely costly. Like we are talking about several billions of dollars. So this would absolutely be out of the question to create the swarm of specialized robot equivalent to Curiosity to build your space colony. And so that's why we need solutions that are way more affordable, but also that are reusable over time, so that we can really reuse the same hardware to do multiple things. And I think this is what we should aim at in the future if we want to create those space colony. And I think this is also the main weakness we have at the moment. We're starting to see a bit of evolution, for example, with a mission like the Perseverance rovers, where you have main rovers and you have a smaller other robots, Ingenuity, and both together they're working in order to more efficiently explore the environment. And this is a type of collaboration we will need also if we want to go towards more autonomous system and larger colonies on other planets.
So essentially, you would want a lot of smaller robots, which provide both affordability, reusability, and I suppose durability for a wide range of potential actions, where they could do completely different things, things that they might not have even been intended to use, perhaps, in that sense. You're saying that you'd want them to be sort of working alongside the more specialized robots, such as you mentioned, as Ingenuity was doing?
Absolutely. The goal would be not to replace heritage technology, but to work, as you mentioned, alongside some specialized robots. But over time, we have thought of space as something very specific that needs very different kind of framework of way of thinking. But the moment you say, I want to create a space colony, a space settlement with humans there, who are going to live there permanently, or let's say for extended periods of time, then the issues that you're going to face will be very similar to what you would have on Earth. Let's say if you were to create a new city somewhere in the desert, then you will need to be able to sustain life over there. So you will need to build the infrastructures, you will need to maintain the infrastructures, and we need to have helping platforms so that they can support human on-site. And the problem you would be facing on Earth would be very similar to the one you will face in space in this case. So you will need robots that are able to do exactly what you would do on Earth, but in space in this case. So you would definitely have specialized robots, but you would definitely also have platforms that can assume different tasks over time in order to reduce your overall costs. If you think about the new city example that I just gave, if you want to build this city, the construction machinery is there, can be reused for many things. You can build, let's say, the foundation of the city, but you can also afterwards transport materials around. In the future, you might be able also to transport people around using the same thing. And this type of reusability is something we should really keep in mind when we build those new settlements there. So I think both aspects are important, specialization, but also more versatility in the system.
A very diverse functionality in that sense, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, diverse functionalities, but keeping the performance quite high, because this is definitely a constraint that you have in the space domain. You cannot have low performance, otherwise your system is not viable.
So can you tell me about any missions at JAXA that you were or are involved with? You know, the mission objectives, your role on those missions, and what you would personally hope to achieve from these missions?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was mentioning before, the goal of my work at JAXA was really to start from scratch with innovative methods. So it's very difficult to, in fact, work on an existing mission when you have this kind of objective in mind, because it's very risky. And this is not something in the space domain that we tend to, at least in space robotics, that we tend really to value a lot. We have to be very careful because those missions involve quite a lot of cost. But during my time at JAXA, one of the missions I was able to work on is called the Uzume mission. And the goal of this mission is to explore lunar caves on the moon. So on the moon, those caves are in fact results from past volcanic activity on the moon. They are basically big tunnels. And those big tunnels are quite interesting in terms of scientific research, but also if we want to build future habitats for human settlers. And the reason is that inside those caves, the temperature is almost constant and you are protected from the radiation, solar radiations, which make it a good candidate both to try to find traces of life or of water, but also to protect human settlers. However, those type of environments are very challenging to explore, because the way we usually access those caves, or we think we can access them, is using what we call the skylight. And it's basically where part of the ceilings of those big tunnels have collapsed, and you need basically to go through a very big opening that is around 100 meters in diameter. And there is a drop of about 100 meters to access the bottom of those tunnels, of those caves. So it's extremely challenging for robotic platforms to explore those environments. And the goal of the Uzume mission is to carry out this first exploration of those environments, and ultimately in the future, to build a human base inside those caves. And my particular task for this project has been to try to design robots that would be able to bring a payload, so it can be instrument, can be infrastructures, from the top of the lunar surface to the bottom of those caves, so that we can start building some infrastructures there. And kind of underlying assumption was that I needed to create solutions that were cheap, or at least affordable, so that we can carry a lot of robots and a lot of payload from the surface to the bottom. And this has been one of the missions I participated to. And my objective there, let's say my hope, was really to be able to participate to the upcoming launch for this mission, which will be, I think, around 2030 or 2035, depending on what will be the evolution of this particular mission. And I would say this is one of the core missions I worked on at JAXA. But I also collaborated with international partners on other missions. One of them, which is kind of more an exploratory mission, is, or let's say, project, has been done with some partner in the UK. And the goal for this particular mission was to design a new type of what we call solar sail. So a solar sail is in fact, if you want a big thin film of materials that using solar pressure, or if you want solar wind, to move efficiently in the solar system. So it's a very cheap way to move things around in the solar system, but it has many challenges. And one of them is, how do you deploy the large structure like that in space? And this particular mission is trying to address exactly this aspect by creating a kind of reconfigurable, or let's say robotic, solar sail that can change its shape in order to adapt to where you want to go and how fast you want to go. So basically, it would be like having a sail on a boat on Earth, but this particular sail is actuated, so it can change its shape automatically to adapt to the type of wind you are receiving and where you want to go. And this is what we are trying to create for space application. So I would say those are two missions I've been working on since I arrived at JAXA, and both have been going, I would say, relatively smoothly.
Both of those sound quite interesting. We'll start by getting into the Uzume mission. I actually know a thing or two about that. I've been slightly involved with it as well, and I've seen some of the papers and information on it. It is an interesting mission, and it's, I think, a lot closer to becoming a reality than a lot of the other missions that are out there right now. I guess you mentioned a lot of different things about how the moon could be a potential habitat for humans in the near future as well, and how these lunar lava tubes, or these tunnels created by supposedly from volcanic activities that happened sometime way in the past. I'm not sure exactly how long ago. Do we have an estimate on that, by the way?
So no, I mean, at least not from my side. I mean, okay. You would have to ask your scientist. But there, as you mentioned, I mean, it's long gone. I mean, it's really a very long time ago. And the only remnant now are those caves and those lava tubes that we find there in the craters, and also the volcanoes. But I mean, it's completely extinguished at this point.
Two of the things that you mentioned that would be good for potential habitats in those areas are, one would be low radiation. So my understanding is that the radiation on the surface of the moon is definitely not something that humans could withstand for any long period of time. How is the radiation within the tunnels? Is it more similar to like Earth equivalent, or is it still quite high but sustainable? What levels are we talking about?
So in terms of radiation, basically the more materials you have on top of you, the more protected you are. So if you would like to have a level of radiation that is, I would say, non-lethal, we cannot exclude that it still has some impact, but at least it's not going to kill you as quickly. Let's put it this way. You would need on the surface at least 4 meters of surface materials above you to protect you. So you can imagine if you go in those caves where you have more than, you have tens of meters, maybe 50 or 80 meters of materials, then you reach level of radiation that are harmless, basically. And this is something that it is highly beneficial, of course. But you have to keep in mind that it's introducing other challenges. But that would be the goal, really, to reduce those radiation to a point where they are not, let's say, an issue anymore.
You also mentioned that the temperature would be a lot more stable, I think. How many degrees would it be on the moon's surface, for reference?
So, of course, it depends if which face of the moon. I mean, if it's the one facing the sun or the one that is in the darkness.
Oh, yes.
This is one of the main issues in the surface of most of the planets, is that you have huge variation in temperature depending on the time of the day, I mean, you are in. So you have variation, for example, from, let's say, around minus 250 degrees Celsius
to the cold, opposite, yes.
Which is quite cold. I mean, it's colder than in Canada, but I mean, it's quite cold. But you would go during the day to temperature in the high positive. I mean, so you go basically from minus 200 to almost plus 200. So I mean, this is a huge variation. But in those caves, you have a temperature of around minus 20 degrees Celsius all the time, which is cold, but I mean, it's something that you find easily on Earth. And this is not something that is that is, let's say, too hard to protect against.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as you mentioned, minus 20, you could probably get colder than that. You mentioned Canada, I guess Northern Canada would be like that, or even in Hokkaido in Japan. Yeah, you could find temperatures like that, or even colder sometimes during the year. Yeah, so minus 20 degrees is still pretty cold, but definitely a lot more sustainable than minus 250 degrees Celsius. But we would still also need, I suppose, since the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, we would need some way to get breathable air and everything in there. Do you know if there's any plans to building a habitat in these lunar lava tubes that could sustain that? Or is that still another step ongoing, or maybe something outside your field? I don't know.
No, I mean, that's a very good point. And as you mentioned, the main difference between the mission we are currently planning and the past mission is that those missions needs to be sustainable. So we need to be able to produce resources on site. And oxygen is one of those resources. And so one way to do it would be to find, to be able to produce hydrogen and to find water on site. And so that we can derive after oxygen for us, for humans, our human settlers. And in fact, this is the only way to build those habitats. It would absolutely not be sustainable to bring the resources you need, all the resources you need from Earth. As you might imagine, even if you were to develop an infrastructure around the moon that is the process of bringing things from the orbit of the moon to the surface of it, it will still be at huge cost, and it will be kind of quite hazardous. So doing so, having those sustainable base really require to be able to exploit the resources on site. So it means also find ways to extract resources. First of all, maybe find resources reliably, mm-hmm. exploit those resources and transform them into something that is usable, and have a reliable process to ensure that this is safe for future human settlers. And all those aspects needs to be met before we are able to have a video base on the surface of the moon. So it's still in the far future, but I think it's important to work on all those infrastructure right away.
So essentially, I think there's a lot of work going into this, and even if things don't go exactly according to what we're hoping they will, I mean, I think a lot of the knowledge and technology that has been obtained will definitely be reusable one way or another. But in terms of the Uzume project, or creating long-term settlements in lunar lava tubes or on the moon itself, it would, I guess, be essential that we found water or some way to produce oxygen on site at the current state. And if this isn't something that ends up happening, would this be, I guess, the end of this particular mission with the long-term objective anyway? Of creating settlements, or would there be sort of a redundancy there, a backup plan to continue this mission another way? For example, as you mentioned, it might not be sustainable bringing things from Earth, but maybe there would be a plan to do something like that instead. Do you have any insight into that? Anything that you know about?
So I think that's a very good point. And I think, in fact, if, for example, we were not able to extract resources from the moon, it would for sure have a huge impact in the interest of the moon itself to be able to host a space colony. But we have also to remember one thing is that in the scope of, let's say, space exploration, the goal of developing technology on the moon is also to serve as a stepping stone for future exploration on Mars. So all the technologies that we want to develop for the moon are also developed in such a way that we can ascertain that they are efficient, we can test them fully in a space environment, and maybe reuse them, adapt them for future Mars missions with humans on board. So I would say nothing is lost, even if we cannot build a base on the moon. And I think what would happen if really we cannot use those resources would be trying to find ways to easily move resources from the Earth to the moon, which mm-hmm. is also in itself a kind of a good goal. I would say. But it's a different one, of course. But I think both could be a solution to kind of circumvent some of these shortcomings.
Let's say that we did have a settlement within these tunnels underneath the surface of the moon. If we wanted to get resources from Earth to the moon, first, I guess we'd have to put them in a rocket, send them to the moon or to the surface of the moon. And from the surface, the part that you would be working on would be to take those materials, bring them to this the skylight, this long, you said 100 meter drop tunnel, bring the resources down into that tunnel and take them to the base itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I would say maybe one slight correction. I think the process for resources on the moon will be more in the future to go from Earth with a rocket to a station orbiting the moon, and then mm-hmm. from a station orbiting the moon to the surface with a cargo system. At least this is what is planned for now, because it's easier to do it this way and to have a kind of standardized way of cargoing things from orbit to the surface than to directly go on the surface of the planet from Earth. So I think this would be one part. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, indeed, what I'm working on right now is more cargoing of things from the surface to the bottom of the cave in a cheap way. And it can be, as you said, many type of resources. It could be building materials, could be instrument, it could be just, for example, oxygen or just energy also. One thing that is really missing in those caves, it's difficult to reuse or to use solar energy. Because by definition, if you're in a cave, then it's completely dark. And so you will need a way to move energy from the entrance of the cave to the inside of the cave efficiently, but it might not be sufficient to sustain your activities. So you need new ways of creating energies there.
See, so there's definitely a lot of tasks that you'd need to consider moving forward in this mission. And I guess that also creates a lot of milestones for the project as well, though. Ways to tell if the project is truly on course, what corrections need to be made, what can be further utilized as well. There's a lot of interest there. Yeah.
And maybe if I can rebound a bit on that, as we were saying before, this is also an example of things that can be useful for Earth application. And if you remember a few years ago, there was a very big search and rescue mission in a cave to try to save people that have been blocked after doing exploration of those caves. And this is a perfect example of where those type of robots could be useful. If mm-hmm. we have developed something for those space environments, those caves that can efficiently move despite the lack of energy, then we could really think of porting this technology for search and rescue in cave on Earth. And this would be, of course, tremendously useful. But I think this link there is also something that we should always try to have in those space projects, direct link with direct application on Earth that are really useful.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think it's something that a lot of people probably overlook, and maybe even during the research, the researchers sometimes might forget about it, but the findings from your research and the your engineering can be utilized for potentially a wide range of things, you know, helping save lives and assisting with so many different problems that are currently happening on Earth. And I guess I do have a question there also regarding collaboration and how you sort of, is there any way that you can find out what the needs of people are, what other people might be working on? Maybe there's groups of people who specifically are looking for new ways, innovative ways to help people who are trapped in caves, for example. Perhaps your research is in line with this. Is this something that there's regular collaboration in this way or regular helping each other out in some form? Or do you have to go looking for these opportunities yourself? How does this work?
So that's a very good point also. And this is something that is a bit, I would say, it's more difficult if you're working in the space agency to create those type of collaboration. Because of some restriction we have when working in this type of environment. But in general, yes, definitely we need to have this interdisciplinary collaboration because those type of problems are very complex. And you really need to have people extremely knowledgeable in those fields to be able really to pinpoint what is needed. For my particular project, we have reached out to different universities or research centers, which have been focused on search and rescue mission, for example. So they know exactly what the rescuer needs and how those missions are settled. And I mean, what type of human factor we have to consider. This is also something in terms of human factors that we don't really have at the moment for space, because I mean, there is no one in space at the moment on the surface. And designing a robotic system that works independently from humans is way easier than, in a sense, than designing a system that needs to work with human around or when there is the pressure of saving some lives.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that is, of course, completely different. Because if the goal of your mission is really to save people, where you have a time constraint, you need, of course, to be able to not do more damage than good when you send your robots around. And those type of constraints are, of course, critical. So it's a different way of designing your mission and designing your robots. And to do so, we really need to have expert knowledge in the field. And this is something that we reach out. If you are in a university, I would say it's easier, of course. It is easier to collaborate with different groups, but we definitely do it also in our case to gain more and more expert knowledge in those fields.
Yeah, that's definitely something great that you are able to reach out. I think it must be quite time consuming and perhaps not always pan out, or maybe more often than not. But that's definitely, I think, an important step in getting your research to actually be utilized and helpful or a use for the common good of all people.
I think one of the main challenges in this type of collaboration is most often that we don't have a common language. This type of, we have, I think it's true for all the field, not only robotics, but I was working in the past on robots to be applied for an assistive environment for people with disabilities a long time ago when I was doing my PhD. And in this scope, we asked to interact with medical professionals, so doctors, nurses. And of course, it's sometimes hard to discuss some idea because they are coming from a field that is vastly different from ours, and their set of constraints is vastly different too. And it's hard to find sometimes a common ground. But I think it's very important for roboticists to work towards being more able to really communicate with those different fields. Because at the end of the day, you don't build robots for the sake of building robots. You build robots with an application in mind. And each application will be different and will require you to tailor your particular platform to this particular problem. And to do so, you will have to interact with people who are not roboticists. And I think this is really something that sometimes we tend to forget, because when you work in robotics, you like robots usually, and you work only on robots all day long. But you need to keep in mind that there is an application for your work, and that needs to be really considered fully. And to do so, you need to have this interaction with people who are not experts in your field.
I'm definitely going to get back to you on what you did during your PhD and before and your life up to that. But in terms of the Uzume project, I did have one more question, one more thing that I wanted to check here. But you mentioned that there's a 100-meter drop into this lunar lava tube on the moon. On the gravity on the moon would be quite different from Earth. How does this compare to a drop on Earth? And what kind of height drops are you actually using on Earth when testing out these your early prototypes?
Yeah, so that's also a good point. As you know, so the gravity on the moon is way lower than we have on Earth. So roughly speaking, and we have no atmosphere also on the moon. So roughly speaking, a 100-meter drop on the moon would be something around 17 to 19 meters on Earth. So let's say 20 meters, if you want, on Earth, which is quite a huge drop. I mean, even on Earth, I mean, if you were to drop something from 20 meters high, I mean, it's significant in terms of energy that you release.
Mm-hmm.
So We have been testing prototypes for this transportation system, and we have used this height, a height of around 17 meters at most, to test the prototype. But we are planning to extend it further to really see if it's robust enough.
Probably what a lot of people might not consider when they think of robots falling from high heights, they tend to think of well, maybe not they, but I'm if it was me, the first thing that would come to mind is, you know, just a solid piece of some kind of metallic substance just falling from a high height and hitting the ground and being completely undamaged, or like we see in the movies, the humanoid robots jumping and landing, you know, one knee in the dirt and then standing up immediately. And I think some of the things that probably need to be taken into consideration are most of the equipment, especially for space development, has to be super lightweight, mostly for economic and transportation reasons, I think. But the chance of such material being damaged from a drop is so much higher than we tend to consider outside of actually trying these experiments. I mean, and anything that these robots might be carrying as well, a scientific payload, if you will. I don't know if they'd be like carrying glass vials or anything quite so crude, but you know, so much can be damaged from such a fall of, you know, 20 meters, or in Earth terms, 20 meters or even less, you know, could.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. I think one good analogy would be to consider a car. So if you're in your car as a human, if you were to travel, you know, at a kind of reasonable speed, and then you crash into something, the car around you needs to be able to absorb this energy and dissipate it so that you are not hurt. And this is exactly what we have with those space instruments and those space equipment. What we want is to be able to dissipate the energy of the fall so that what we are carrying is not damaged. One thing also we have to consider is that the ground property in those caves, of course, is still partially unknown, but we still have some hypotheses on what it could be. And it's very different if you fall into sand, or if you fall into rocks, or if you fall into something that will collapse below you. So if we take the example of the very solid spheres there that could indeed withstand such a drop, but then maybe if there is sand or something underneath, that's going just to be buried into the sand, and then all your equipment is lost. So I would say we really have to consider every parameters into the system before being able to design an efficient solution.
And I guess there's a lot of unknowns as well, since my understanding is that we don't know exactly what the bottom of the skylight or inside these lunar lavatubes, what the exact material would be. So it could be hard rock or soft sand or a mixture of both. Not knowing this and yet having to drop something down there means that you really have to consider, I guess, a lot of different angles.
Absolutely. And I think in this case, what's important is to basically create a kind of trade-off solution. We have to consider the worst case scenarios, and see how our robots could kind of, let's say more than the robot, the system itself could kind of do quite good in all of those different scenarios. I mean, rock, sand, and so on. It's probably a mixture of both. And it's also depend, I think, where you're going to land in the skylight. I mean, there is no evidence that we have a kind of homogeneous terrain there. You might be very unlucky and just end up in a very big rock. Or you might just end up in something quite soft that will also help you land safely. So it's really, as soon as you have some unknown in your system, you really need to consider the different scenarios, the branches, and try to find a good trade-off between all the solutions.
So I wanted to get into the solar sails project that you're also working on. But first of all, you mentioned that you're working with UK partners in, I guess, an international collaboration. And I know in the space industry, you don't just have collaborations outside of particular fields, as you were mentioning with the USME project, where you would like to contact people potentially in search and rescue or other fields who could, you know, collaborate with your work and maybe utilize it in various different ways. but also you will have international collaborations. And I know this is very common in the space industry, as it's a very international industry, but at the same time, there's time zone differences, there's language differences, there's legal requirements of each country and organization. And I think there's a lot of troubles that could also arise in international collaborations, or things that make it difficult. How do you feel about that? Do you find international collaborations to be overall a good thing? And are they difficult, or are they, how do you find it?
So I would say it really depends. Let's say overall, it's a very good opportunity to bring people together, and it's working, at least in my case and for my projects, very well, and it's very rewarding. I would say there is a huge difference between collaborating with a university and collaborating with a space agency or a company, because as you mentioned, there are a lot of let's say administrative constraint, laws, regulation, but those are way more heavy on the side of companies and space industry. So the project we have, for example, with our UK partners, is in fact with the university. So they have way more leeway in what they can do and what they can share than if it was with the ESA or other space agency. And I would say that in our case, we make the efforts of for sometimes having meetings quite late for some people or quite early for some others, because I think the outcome is worth it. The knowledge that we gain and what we manage to create using those collaboration is really something we would not have at the domestic level only. So I think in my case, I see those type of collaboration as really positive. And even if they represent also some challenges sometimes.
How is it for the solar sails collaboration in particular? Have things been proceeding smoothly, in your opinion?
So absolutely. So this is a very, let's say, early stage project. The goal of the first phase of this project was really an exploration of the concept and really trying to find if it is viable or not. And it was a 6 months project for which we got financial support from the UK government. And we acted, my team at JAXA acted as main international collaborators on this project. And at the end of the 6 months, we managed to have working prototype for some subparts of the project. And we managed also to publish one journal paper, so a scientific publication summarizing what we have found. And now we hope to be able to go to the next stage, which would be a more large-scale grant, a funding opportunity to be able to go more into the space readiness aspect of the project and really start more large-scale testing. And so overall, I would say it has been a very productive collaboration. And also, but I must point out there that the main collaborator we have in the UK is a former a member of JAXA, which of course helps tremendously in terms of this collaboration, because basically it's a former a friend of mine. So it's way easier to communicate with someone you know quite well than with a total stranger. But I think overall, it's still it's going very smoothly, even without that.
The robotic solar sails itself, you said that they would change shape in regards to the direction of the winds, and these are solar winds. I think the concept of solar winds is still somewhat difficult for some people to grasp. Could you give us a sort of a brief, easy to understand explanation of what solar winds are and how they work?
So I think it's also difficult to grasp for me as a roboticist. That's why we have scientists, expert in this field working in the project. But overall, you can imagine that as being more the pressure that the sun, exerts by its light on different surfaces. And this pressure varies depending on the illumination of your surface. And as such, you can basically move in space using this concept. And I would say the solar wind is kind of an illustration of this. It's kind of similar to what really you would have on Earth with this kind of wind that changed direction and so on, except it's a bit more regular, I would say, in the solar system. So the reason why we want to be able to actuate our solar sail is very similar to what you would have on a real boat, for example. The sail were actuated so that you can really catch the wind and orient your sail so that you go in the right direction. And at the moment, with current solar sail, we have a very a poor control of where we can go and what we can do. Basically, we go wherever we end up, and we don't have much control. So we really want to improve this to have a reliable system to be able to move around very cheaply. Well, this is one of the great advantages also of this system is that it's very cheap. It's exactly what you have on Earth with the big boats that are just propelled by the wind. So you don't have basically a cost, an energy cost associated to it. And this is something that is we would like to replicate really in space.
If this could be done efficiently, would this also be something that you could use for bringing things from the Earth, for example, to the Moon or Mars by utilizing the solar sails? Or is this more of a let's say, a longer distance idea?
So I think, so in the case of the Earth and the Moon, I think it would not really be something viable because they are, I mean, all things considered, very close together. So here, this is not something we should consider. For Mars, maybe, but one of the main disadvantages, in fact, of those solar sails is that they are slow. Things move slowly in space using that. It's not that like you have a very strong propellers that go very fast. So it would be, let's say, viable for something that doesn't have a huge time constraint on it, like a cargo. If you need to ship oxygen, and people are waiting for the oxygen on the other side, it's not a good idea to use this system because you might find that you have exceeded the time that you had to ship it. But for building things very far away or for shipping things in the orbits of other planets, then this could be a viable method. In fact, the ultimate goal of this system is to be able to populate the solar system with kind of hub, robotic hub around the main planets or the main point of interest that would stay there and waiting to be used in the future for other missions and doing so very cheaply by using those solar sails. So we are not aiming at fast travel. We are aiming at something steady and cheap. To be able to create the stepping stone for future mission.
Just so I have the idea correct here, the solar sails, they would be used, as you mentioned, similar to a boat sail, but it would only receive the pressure from the solar winds when going in the direction that you'd actually want it to go, and it would change shape to not receive any winds that might blow it off course. This would be done pretty much all automatically if the system is functioning correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that also you have to take into account in those type of system, everything you're working in space, so not on planetary surfaces. One thing that is very important is that every time you change shape, you're introducing in your system some momentum for what you have in classic physics. So if you change your shape quickly and you are, for example, already rotating, then you are going to change the momentum of your system. And you, for example, you might increase your rotation speed or velocity and the overall direction of your orientation of your platforms. And that's why when you move something that is quite big, like a solar sail, the fact of moving also introduces some perturbation in your orientation. That's why such a system has to be designed in a way that this change in orientation and configuration does not affect the direction you want to move towards. Because of course, there is no point in orienting your sail and then having your boat completely change direction at the same time. Then you will lose completely the let's say, the advantage of doing so. So we have basically to balance both aspects when we do that. And I must say that, of course, my field of specialization is more surface robotics. So I work more on robotics on the surface of planets. But I think this field is also very interesting and very challenging. But I require most assistance for my science colleagues on this particular topic.
Whether it's working with the solar sails or on the Uzme project and sending robots into large caverns, for example, or whatever other project that you might be working on, do you generally tend to start with computer simulations or do you jump right into some sort of hardware tests immediately?
The first thing we start with is the characterization of the problem on paper. I think this is, before jumping into anything,
yes, that makes
first,
sense. Yeah.
First things to do. But afterwards, almost 100% of the time, I would say, we go for simulation. But simulation is most of the time not completely disjoint from hardware experiment. And most of the time, when you want to simulate a robotic system, you also use what we call hardware in the loop simulation, meaning that you do part of your experiment in hardware so that you can calibrate your simulation to make sure that it's close to the environment you are trying to replicate and that it behaves the same way as real hardware. So, and it's especially true if you have very complex system to simulate. I would say it's a big mistake in this case to consider that both are independent. Having a perfect model in simulation and running all your hypothesis, all your control system, all your hardware development using only that is a recipe for disaster, because afterwards it would be almost impossible to transfer this knowledge to the real hardware platforms that you are going to build. So those are not independent. And I would say most of the times there is also back and forth between simulation and hardware. You will create your simulation, calibrate it, obtain some result, test it in hardware, and use that to improve your simulation and move forward with a better model.
So you also mentioned that you put out a journal paper and you are involved in I guess a few missions here and several different projects. I want to know, how specifically do you either put together or join, whether it's a research paper or a project in your field, and what are the most important points that you actually take into consideration when you're either looking to either join an existing project or start a new one yourself?
And so I would say maybe let's distinguish so journal publication and maybe project joining projects there. So I would say for me, in terms of project, I'm trying to join project where I'm useful or I could be useful. And I think this is the key thing, is that it's first of all to maybe check what the project goals are and what the proposed methodology is, and maybe see if you can find some aspect where your expertise could be useful. And I think what I've been doing, in fact, to be able to be involved in those projects is contact the main PI, so the main researcher in those projects, and just propose some concrete idea where what I know or my expertise could be useful. So this is, I think, is the best way to do so, is to try to really propose concrete research question or concrete aspects where your expertise could be useful. In terms of journal publication, for me, I am not someone who is particularly focused on doing research for the sake of publishing. I see publication as basically a secondary outcome of what you are doing. So I think they should be organic to the process. So basically you are doing your research, you have been able to find interesting results and you would like to share them with the community. So you decide to write a journal paper so that you can share with everyone and maybe get some meaningful criticism or comments that would help you move forward. But I don't see the goal of my work as publishing paper in this case.
Mm-hmm. You are involved in quite a few different projects or were involved during your time at JAXA. You had to work on simulations and hardware, write research papers, and do a lot of different tasks, I believe. How exactly did you end up organizing your day?
So I think it really depends on which phase you are in for your project. Because, of course, sometimes, let's say if you are in the design phase, you will spend most of your day, I mean, in your simulation or in your CAD software, trying to build your structure, test it, and so on. If you are more advanced in the project and you are starting working with hardware, you will need to take care also of the production, the assembly, the testing using specific test facilities. So I would say it depends what phase you are considering. But another aspect also is that most researchers also have students to supervise. So this is a very important aspect of science and of research, is that in my case, for example, I was supervising several students at the same time. So part of your day will also be dedicated to checking with your student what they have done, I mean, what they are doing, and which research directions they are currently pursuing. And this is quite an important part. So I would say in a typical day, you are going to spend, again, most of your time for one or two tasks in the project, and the rest will be secondary. But those two tasks will, of course, depend on the phase of the project. It can be, for example, simulation and hardware testing, or it can be even student supervision or trying to finish your paper and summarizing your different findings. It can also be writing of a grant to get funding, which is also taking quite a lot of our time as researcher, because as you probably know, we are dependent on the funding we receive, and to receive some funding, we need to write convincing grants in order to receive it. So this is also occupying quite a lot of our time. I would say one constant almost every day as a researcher is reading some scientific publication, some scientific papers, because the field is ever expanding. And one very important thing is to keep up to date with what's happening. So I would say almost every day you are going to read part of your scientific papers or several of them in order to keep updated on what's happening.
Always be reading, always be keeping up to date with the state of the art. I guess if you aren't doing that, then there could be some breakthroughs in your field, or I guess a lot of hints on whatever you're currently working on that could be helpful, or in some cases, maybe even a hindrance to what you're doing. But that's a good point. I would also like to get into your career history. You mentioned earlier that during your PhD, you were working with medical experts, and it's sort of a wider field as well. In this question, I would like to know, I guess, a wide range of things, starting from maybe where you were born and raised, and where you went to school, where you got your PhD, what you studied then, and everything up until you got to JAXA, or anything of particular interest that you feel you would like to share.
That's going to be a long answer. I mean, I'm so old right now. I was born in France. I spent most of my youth there. I mean, for my childhood there, in a city that is very close to the border with Switzerland and with Geneva in particular. So I was spending quite a lot of time in Switzerland and in France at the time. So I was early on interested in robotics. And so I tried to orient myself towards this field. And I did, in fact, an engineering degree in France, where I studied applied mathematics and modeling. And afterwards, I decided to spend a year in Canada, in fact, in the University of Waterloo, where I worked at the artificial intelligence lab. I wanted to get a better understanding of what research was, because as an engineer, most of the time you do more, let's say, concrete application. And then I definitely, let's say, wanted to work on robotics and robotics that were distributed system, meaning multiple units working together. So afterwards, after my stay in in Canada, I finally got my engineering degree, and I joined the biorobotics lab at EPFL in Switzerland. And here, the goal of my project was to work on a new type of robots called Roombots, which was a modular robot. And so modular robots is a robot, it's a robotic system in which instead of having one unit, you have multiple units that have the ability to come together to form various shape. And by doing so, those different configuration will be able to solve a different set of tasks. So you can imagine a modular robot as Lego blocks that comes together and that can assemble in various shape to create various structures. And so I was working with these particular robots, and the goal of the project was to create an assistive environment, as I said before, for people with disabilities. So you can imagine an environment that would help a person in a wheelchair by just moving the furniture around or by just assisting the person in general to move into his or her environment. And for this particular project, I was mainly working on trying to find ways for those robots to learn how to move efficiently in the environment and also how they should interact with the person. Because one key issue with those robots is that they are highly what we call non-anthropomorphic. So they don't look like a human. And with robots like humanoid robots, it's kind of more intuitive how you would communicate with them. You could speak, you could just maybe move their hands and something like that. But with a robot that doesn't look at all like a human, you need to find new ways to kind of interact with them. And this was part of my project there, finding those new type of interaction. We explore many things like augmented reality, like gestures and so on. And you have to remember, I'm quite old, so this was maybe almost 10 years ago now. So we didn't have all the technology we have at this point. So, and this project was quite successful. We were able to form a nice consortium working on that with medical professionals all around Europe. And the project got quite far, but at this point, it is more used as a research tool and not really widespread in I would say society. And afterwards, I decided to move to MIT, where I work on another modular robot called M-Blocks. And the goal of this robot, the goal of my project for this particular robot, was to make it more space ready, to see how we could use these platforms for space applications. And this is really where I started to develop more space related, I would say, control methods and hardware solution. And this is also where I decided to apply for my current position, let's say my former position at JAXA. And after so 1 year at MIT, I received an offer from JAXA to join their lab. And this is where I started working more on really specific space robotic application. So in a few words, this is a bit my career so far. And once again, I'm quite old, so it was quite a long description.
So was it the allure of working on space robotics that brought you to JAXA in the first place?
So yes, and I would say multiple things. I would say definitely the opportunity to work on concrete space application, which is something I always wanted to do. And in fact, I've always been interested in robotics, but in space robotics in particular. And I would say all the applications that I worked on through the years of my research career were really, I always had in mind a space application. So I've been reusing, in fact, most of my work from my PhD and postdoctoral fellowships for my current work at JAXA. So this is not something that was completely disconnected. And I would say really what motivates me was this opportunity to work on real missions and something concrete.
So you have recently finished a long-term contract at JAXA and you're moving on to something new. What is next for you?
So at the moment, normally I'm going to join a university in the Tokyo area. And the goal of this new project that I'm going to start, I'm still going to work on my past project, to continue working on them. But more precisely, the new project I'm going to work more intensely on would be a project aiming at creating automated system for building infrastructure on the moon. So it's still very close to what I was doing before, with more emphasis on the building aspect of things. So I will manage my time. Maybe 80% of my time will be focused on this particular project, which is part of something bigger. And 20% of my time will be more focused on my past project and continuing what I've started with my colleague at JAXA.
I'd also like to ask if you have any notable hobbies, anything that you really like to do that is fun for you when you're not busy engineering new robots.
So I have a few things that I've had for a long time. So for example, I really like gardening. I have the chance here in Japan of having a house with a small garden. I always try to plant vegetables and flowers, and I think it's very relaxing. I also really like to do hiking, and I think I like some let's say image of maybe the Tokyo area that people might have, as there are lots of hikes that you can do around there that are quite interesting and quite relaxing. Really enjoy exploring a bit this way. And maybe the last notable thing that I'm doing is also cycling. And in fact, since I arrived in Japan, I really enjoy cycling more long distance than before. I like going cycling to the ocean or to the mountain. I think it's also very relaxing for me. Those, I would say, are the three main things that I'm that occupies my time outside of my work.
And I understand that you would often be cycling to and from work almost every day as well.
I do. Yes, I do. But it's not really long distance. It's around 20, between 20 and 25 kilometers both ways. Basically,
each way?
Total.
Oh, total.
So,
okay.
I mean, it's not so much.
It's still quite a bit of cycling for most people anyway. 20 to 25 kilometers almost every day, basically, you were doing.
Yes, every day. And I think it's helping you to, you know, to keep in shape. But I think it's also, for me, it's very important to start the day after having done some physical activities. And I think it's also help having a clear separation between your work and afterwards your house, your home. So to have clear separation between those two activities. So I kind of enjoy having this kind of break after work and before going to work. I think it's for me, I enjoy quite a bit.
And you also enjoy, you said gardening and hiking. You quite enjoy nature.
I would say in general, yes. And gardening is also a way to offer very fresh vegetables because I also really like cooking, maybe to a fault because I think it's, if you're not careful and you cook too much, you might gain some weight. So it's not so good, but yes, I do enjoy nature in general, which is why I always try to be more in nature than in places in big cities and so on, which might be a bit counterintuitive since I'm living very close to the biggest city in the world, Tokyo. But
you said that even near or around Tokyo, there's a lot of hiking spots or places in nature that you can go.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it's the only things, of course, since Tokyo is a very big city, there are also a lot of people. So it's kind of hard to find places that are a bit more remote where you can enjoy being a bit more alone. And I did travel in Japan, in other places like the north of Japan, which I'm really fond of, the Akita Prefecture, the Iwate Prefectures. And there, of course, you can find more nature with less people. But I think even around Tokyo, there are lots of things to explore.
And you prefer, whether you're hiking or whatever, to be alone when you're doing it?
Yes. I mean, I do enjoy also the company of others, I mean, for those activities, but most of the time I am alone. And I think it's more personality traits than anything else. But in my research, I prefer to be working in teams than alone. So I would say maybe it's just so that I can balance both.
So when you're working on cutting edge robotic technology, you're working with people, and then you go into nature all by yourself to sort of have these two different worlds in your life.
Exactly. I think that's the same concept as for the bike commute, is to separate both and to enjoy different aspects.
It's interesting. I don't think we've had anybody on the podcast who's had a gardening hobby before. That's interesting. And you have your own little garden.
I didn't say I was successful in gardening, but at least I'm trying.
You enjoy it. That's good. I know there's probably a lot of people listening right now who might be interested in robotics in general, or taking part in robotics, maybe considering a future career in robotics. But not necessarily everybody would have access to, let's say, a lab or organization, or even the general resources that you would normally have on hand when doing robotics, or a roboticist would anyway. Do you have any tools or resources, anything either free or cheap or easily accessible, that you could recommend to anybody listening who might be interested in either taking part or potentially even getting into the field of work that you are in?
So I would say, in terms of robotics, there have been tremendous progress for opening this field to the general public. One of the tools, if you're really starting, I think, for example, just using the Lego solutions that you find is already a very good step forward. You can find small kits for kids of all ages to start building your own robots, doing a bit of programming, doing from very simple stuff to way more complex things afterwards. And doing something like that would also help you to kind of apprehend some concepts, to understand, you know, very fundamental concepts and how robotics work as a whole. As you know, robotics is in fact a very vast field. I mean, you have many, many different expertise that needs to come together in order to be able to make a robot work. And I think those type of kits allows you to bring down the complexity of some aspect, but keeping the most fundamental research question and knowledge intact. And also they're well suited for people of different ages. So I think it's good. For adults, I think also there have been a lot of, let's say, progress made in terms of bringing knowledge easily accessible online. Online, you can find tons of resources on, for example, programming virtual robots or in virtual environments. So this has been really something that was not present when I started, you know, working on robotics. And also, there have been lots of efforts in making off-the-shelf solutions for hardware. So you can find, for example, small computers or cheap computer, like the Arduino boards or the Raspberry Pi boards. All those electronics boards will dramatically help you if you want to build your own system in hardware. But I think maybe the easiest way to start in robotics also depend on what you're interested in. I mean, if you think you're more interested in coding or in programming robots, then maybe it's good to invest in something ready-made and create your own coding solution. Conversely, if you're more interested in hardware than coding, then you can find online many existing codes, and maybe you can build your own hardware platform using some ready-made components. So I think there are lots of solutions depending on your budget, depending on your age, depending on your goals also. And if you are a student or even an adult, one good way, I think, to also know if you're really interested in robotics is maybe joining a club or assisting or attending some free lecture at university. Most universities, in fact, are open to public. So you can go there and have a lecture on robotics. And if you take an entry-level class, I mean, I think it could be a very good way to know a bit what robotics entails.
It's interesting. So quite a few potential resources there. Kits such as the Lego robotics kits that you mentioned at the beginning, that would be sort of an easy way to get into both the hardware and programming aspects of it to some degree, I would assume. And then you mentioned that you could pick up things like Arduino boards, which I guess would be sort of putting together the hardware. And then there's a lot of online codes, as you mentioned, if you're more interested in software. Is there any particular programming language that you think somebody who wants to get into robotics should specialize in, or at least make more of a priority compared to other programming languages?
So I think it really depends once again on your goals. So and on your how much time you want to invest in this one. If you want, for example, to do more low level programming, then of course a language like the C language would be, I mean, maybe the way to go, but it's a complex language. And of course, a language a bit more advanced, let's say with different purposes like C++, would also be useful. But once again, this is complicated. I mean, you will need to invest quite a lot of time to become proficient. I would say if you want to have results quickly, a language like Python would be, I think, more accessible. I mean, you would be able to quickly learn it, and you will also be able to do already quite a lot of things because a lot of framework have been developed using this language. So you can build on top of them or using those tools. So this might be the language I would recommend, and it is used widely in the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
Not only for robotics, but for also many in many other domains. So maybe starting with something like that would be better.
And then you also mentioned that a lot of universities will have public access to potential resources or classes or some kind of information that you could likely get. I guess you'd have to look up the universities in your area to determine whether or not this is accessible to you.
I mean, you can do it physically, but you can also do it online. MIT has an open courseware that you can go, and almost all the lectures there are fully open, both the lecture in terms of the lecture itself, but also the materials used, the exercise, the resources. And I think they are doing it for other major university like Cornell in the US also. And I think Tokyo University might also have something similar. I know EPFL has also. So I think there are lots of resources that you can find. And one thing that I would recommend, for example, if you're a student and you want to have more information and you're really hesitating, is to try to contact a lab that you're interested in. Either contact someone there. And I'm sure, I mean, I receive a lot of those demands and I always reply. And I think most researchers are like that. They're very open and would be very happy to give you more details and help you figure out really if you like it or not. You can also do, again, in the scope of being a student, you can also do summer internship. I mean, I've done in the past, I mean, I've supervised a few students doing that. And I think it's a very good way to not only get to know more about the field, but also get to know more about the research environment. I mean, how does research work? I mean, what we are doing and so on. So I think those would be good opportunity to learn a bit more.
Good. And I think on the topic of online universities as well, there are sort of systems in place, like edX is one of the ones that comes to mind, where they have a whole bunch of universities sort of collaborating with courses, often introductory courses that people could take sometimes for free or relatively cheap online. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of resources that way. And as you mentioned, the in-person courses as well exist. So it's a lot of potential opportunity there.
And maybe one thing even simpler, I mean, nowadays you can find everything on YouTube. I know it's, but you can find very good quality content
for
specialized channel in robotics, for example, learning how to program, to create your robot, your hardware and everything. So I think if you are really motivated, the resources are there. But I think it's also important, as I was saying before, in my case, for example, I think it's more efficient to work in team. So if you can be part of a small project or a small robotics club, I think this is really the way to go. You will find a lot of satisfaction joining something like that.
That's interesting. Yeah, this definitely, if you have the opportunity or can find some people to join, it would be probably quite beneficial to put together a team. And I guess similar to your situation for some of the projects that you're involved with, it doesn't necessarily have to be an in-person team either. It could be an international team even of people with similar interests who may also want to, or perhaps are already in robotics and just need assistance with their ongoing projects. So I guess if you look hard enough, there's probably plenty of opportunities for that sort of thing right now.
Absolutely. I think of the whole, I cannot think of any single very successful robotics project that has been done by one person. It's always a team of people working together to achieve such a goal. And I think that's why it's very important to create a team. And it's fun also, which should not be neglected.
So one thing that I like to always ask the guest is just to figure out your what audacious goals that you might have in your scientific field. So if you suddenly had a near unlimited budget, so you had, let's say, $1 trillion to put towards anything in your research field, what would you want to use that on?
I think that's a tough question. It's a tough question because there are many, many things that I would be interested in. I do work in space robotics, but I always try to have application of my work for pressing societal issues. So if I had that much money, definitely this is something, an aspect that I would like to develop more. So I'm a firm believer of the space, let's say, space program, space colonization, and so on. But I think I would invest more of this research budget towards what I was doing maybe in the past, with those assistive environment and helping people, elderly people, with using those robotic solutions. And this is really something that is pressing. To put it bluntly, maybe, I think the space, let's say, colonization problem can wait a bit. And I would solve maybe this first. And I don't mean that I don't like work what I'm doing or what I'm pursuing, but I'm saying that I would go maybe more into this direction than into the one I'm currently pursuing. Or I can do both. If it's really unlimited, then I mean, both would be fine. But this would be something I would work on, definitely.
You would have a lot of the focus of the robotics research be more on current general societal issues rather than space application. If it was one or the other, of course, as you mentioned earlier, I think a lot of these issues themselves, you can develop something for Earth or for space and find applications for the other one. So
absolutely. I think there is, in any case, an overlap between between both. And developing one would mean also developing the others, but I would think to a lesser degree. So I would focus first on those pressing issues on Earth, and then on the second time on the issues in space.
That's great. So one final question I like to always ask, and this is a very open-ended question, but I want to know if you have any interesting fact, theory, suggestion, or piece of information revolving around, I guess, something either we talked about or something to do with your field or robotics or space in general that you would like the audience to think about if they had one thing to take away from all of this, one thing that you want them to consider for the rest of the day listening to this. What would that be?
Is that, it's also a difficult question. I think maybe, well, so maybe two things, so that I'm cheating a bit. I would say two things. One thing that I would say maybe to the people who wants to get into the field of robotics, and one advice I could give them is to always be curious. Don't focus too much on one particular thing. We were discussing before the idea of starting in software or starting in hardware and so on. Robotics is a very wide field with many different aspects. And I think it's very important if you want to be successful in this field to have a general understanding of each of those aspects. Mm-hmm. If a successful roboticist will be specialized in one or two fields, but also will be able to understand, I mean, other experts. And so my advice would really be to be curious and check everything. And the second thing, maybe more to the general public, is that I would recommend to think of robots not too much as enemies, which I think is happening sometimes because we see robots as a way to replace humans for some work or for some activities. But I see them more as helpers. I mean, they're going to help us and to overcome some pressing issues that we have. And their goal is, in the end, to try to alleviate the burden for some works that are really tedious. And this is one aspect. And the other aspect is also the direct help that you can get from robot. As I was saying, for example, in the aspect of assistive environment. So those would be my two things to consider. If you want to get into the field, be curious of everything. And as the general public, think of robots as your friends, not as your enemies.
Thank you for that. It's been a very interesting conversation. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the time. I really enjoyed our chat. And I think it was also very enriching.
All right. Thank you. And everybody, remember, stay curious. Robots are your friends.
Exactly.